You're about to hear a preview of Partially Examined Life supporter exclusive content. To learn how to get the whole thing, check out partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. Hey folks, it's the Partially Examined Life episode 319, part 3, finishing up Friedrich Schiller's On the Aesthetic Education of Man. Just can't get enough of it. Trying to remember where we stopped. 25? Does that seem right? Or 24?
I don't know that we talked about 24 because it's this interesting critique of reason where, you know, in the first instance, reason isn't necessarily an impetus to morality, to ethical behavior, or to some higher use of reason for theoretical inquiry. It actually allows us, right, through hypothetical reason, to just serve our own desires. We can just figure out how to get what we want. Mm-hmm. So man hurls himself and everything to devour it greedily. He's tortured by desire. Schiller refers to this as a quote unquote raw state of nature.
It's a kind of state of nature story.
Yeah. What I thought was interesting is this idea that we start out in a way as rank materialists and reason actually serves that purpose.
And I know there was a term for this that Kant had, and I could not tell you what it is. I mean, instrumental reason, that's probably
hypothetical.
Sure.
That's the word, hypothetical, as opposed to categorical. So hypothetical imperatives are the, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he didn't say hypothetical reason.
No, that's definitely one of the terms Kant uses for it.
Hypothetical imperative is what this kind of reasoning is. I have something I want. How do I get it? If I do this, then I get that, right? The categorical imperative is just, I must do this. There's no other end it serves.
So the reasoning of a thief that would make him a better thief.
Reason can just as much plunge us into servitude of physical life as lead us to an ideal world. It opens up the imagination, but serves the moment. Instead of leading us to truth and morality, it leads us to unlimited yearning, to quote-unquote absolute need. A phrase I like, absolute need. But this word absolute is associated with the absolute, which includes not only God, but our capacity for autonomy to make these choices, which are not related to need, but simply to morality. So absolute need really is a phrase that captures the paradox. The fruits from this tree are all dogmatic eudaimonian systems, lacking in any specificity that might fit them into the present day or an entire life. So criticizing, for instance, utilitarianism or Aristotelian virtue ethics, these were targets for Kant, of course, as well. Starts out the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals to talking about exactly this, why eudaimonian system won't work, relies entirely on the hypothetical imperative. It says it's about happiness and virtue, perhaps, but it really is thinking in terms of our material, empirical existence. Nietzsche is going to make utilitarianism a target too, in much the same vein as Kant or Schiller, but he's going to settle on his own eudaimonian virtue ethics system. And we see hints of that there. We talked about psychological integration, right? So we actually do see hints in Schiller of the very thing that he's criticizing.
Here he's criticizing eudaimonian systems, but it seems like his aesthetic is going to take you directly towards those kinds of things. It's linking feeling to reason.
Part of the theme of this is that too much reason is bad.
Yeah, and I guess he's just putting that eudaimonian systems, and this criticism is just being another example of too much reason. Though it doesn't seem to be necessarily super careful on where he ends up with respect to these things.
You can argue that like Aristotelian virtue ethics in its focus on habituation, right?
Yep.
Essentially psychological health and upbringing and those things is getting at exactly what he's talking about. Reason is not enough.
Yeah, he's certainly being sensitive. His playful impulse and his praise of the aesthetic as a counterbalance to reason wrongly understood or sort of a scientism kind of impulse seems to go in exactly the same direction. But
the next step is that he does talk about how reason raises us, you know. So as soon as man has begun to use his reason and connect causes and purposes in the phenomena he encounters, reason applies its concepts and insists on both an absolute connection and an unconditional cause, right? So the unconditioned conspectus thing, which becomes the absolute in German idealism. So whether it's an unconditional cause in the free subject or in God, we want to explain things, we want to get to causes, but ultimately we want to get to the very first principle. Mm-hmm. And so here's a phrase that I love. So to simply raise such a demand, man must already have gone beyond sensuousness. Doesn't mean we're yet in the practical realm, right? And the ethical would still theoretical. But sensuousness makes use of exactly this demand to recover the truant. This was the big controversy at the time. I think recovering the truant, he's talking about, so the naturalistic framework in materialism and Spinozism, quote unquote, dogmatism, is the truant in the sense that the first attempt at theoretical explanation is always completely material and compromises our practical ability. I mean, compromises the idea that we could be free because we just live in this determined material realm. I think I might be overreading that a little bit. But anyway.
But you're bringing the focus back to another theme, which is him trying to save freedom from reason or determinism, right? By the aesthetic.
So here's the actual point that I was kind of distorting a little bit to fit it into the historical account. But he looks for everything in the sphere of empirical knowledge. And when he realizes, so get skepticism, Humean skepticism, for instance, and then there were a lot of German skeptics as well in the wake of Kant who thought Kant actually just worsened the problem of skepticism rather than solving it. But if you despair that empirical knowledge can be complete, he says you seek this in the sphere of feeling. So in other words, you become nihilists. You never find the absolute and you think that the world is absurd and has no fundamental first principle. Everything is blind coercion of matter. Another great little phrase. And then in the last paragraph, he basically attacks religion, says that, you know, because of this, even the moral law is falsified, especially essentially, and we forfeit humanity by seeking a deity. The religious is purchased at the disposal of humanity. Not a holy, you know, we try to find not a holy being, but a merely powerful one, the kind of God that's worshipped in fear. So I think it's just false. The idea is false religion. I don't think he's coming out explicitly against religion per se, but pretty despairing picture in this 24th. It gets better, but
I wanted to think about this state of nature story and compare it with other ones like Rousseau's or something like that. But he's not going down the direction of the corruption of our natural inclinations by culture, for instance. Too much reason or an imbalance in reason is taking us down this road of being subject only to the material. It smacks of the same kind of materialist criticism that you get, I don't know, like this mid-20th century stuff that we read, that we're too subject to business interests. And I wonder if you would draw a line from here right through Marx in sort of being overly subject to a Marxist criticism of contemporary culture, that you would end up being overly material. That might run against Marx's rationality, but...
Well, it's funny because he says in this letter, yeah, that the fruit of dogmatic systems, of materialist systems, is this utopian ideal, which is all great, except that it's still framed in materialistic terms, which you could argue Marx is and isn't, right?
Yes, that's why I'm stumbling over myself on it, right? Because it feels like you would criticize Marx on this point and that you would invoke Marx on this point.
Right. Because communism is about the equal distribution of material goods, but it's supposed to also lead to spiritual goods, you know, poet in the morning.
Yeah.
It's supposed to allow us to escape the servitude to bad work. And the other thing, and then Marx is in the tradition of Hegel, and the idea is this progressive, for Hegel, right, movement towards knowledge of the absolute. And yeah, Marx just recast that in material terms.
For Marx, if you set up the material conditions, then the spirit will follow, whereas Schiller seems to be saying the opposite, that you need an educational program, which is in part material conditions, but that was specifically the kind of stuff that Marx thought is merely ideologies, merely superstructure, the kind of things that you are taught is going to be a mask, you know, something just to kind of keep your mind occupied while your material circumstances are actually determining everything important about you.
So Schiller would disagree with that the solution is the material to free you for your spiritual, right? He's saying that you have to be addressing both of them. And right now that the condition is that there's just too much material and you need to balance that with the aesthetic.
Yeah, too much material because there's too much reason, ironically. You think, in other words, the 24th is like, you think reason is going to take us away from our animality and the materialism associated with that, the sensuousness associated with that, but in a way it returns us.
Yeah, it doubles down. It leaves us as animals. That's what he's saying in the last paragraph, is that we're not actually made into free men.
Yeah. So trying to leave the sensuous realm ironically backfires. It kind of fuses us more to the sensuous realm.
If that sounds like the kind of thing that you want to hear more about, then please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. Thanks for listening.